You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
We are smoking something special. This comes from Rocky Patel, but this is the...
You want me to pronounce it?
Yeah, let's go ahead, because it's...
The Tabaquero Hamlet.
There you go. Yeah, see, anytime it comes to Spanish pronunciations, you're the go-to.
I watched a lot of Spanish soap operas back in the day.
We didn't have real TV.
Yeah, this cigar is a dedication to, and I mean, it's kind of cool because it doesn't even have, you know, Rocky anywhere listed on the label. It's just a big H with Hamlet Paredes, Master of Tobacco on the label. This is a cigar kind of dedicated to Cuba's most sought after cigar roller and blender, who recently came to the U.S. earlier this year and has been working with Rocky Patel and his burn store in Florida to come up with some new blends and such. And this is like one of the first cigars that they have released together as kind of a dedication to Hamlet.
Yeah. And I mean, this is probably going to be one of the closest Cuban made cigars. I mean, if you look at the construction on this thing, I mean, you know, it's apparent that this guy knows what the hell he's doing when it comes to, you know, crafting a cigar.
This is probably one of the, I mean, it's just looks so well made. I mean, and so far it's been a very tight burn. Just cutting it open and the wrap on it just looks perfect.
Absolutely. So, you know, not to confuse folks, this is not a Cuban cigar, but, you know, this is sporting the San Andreas wrapper with a
Nicaraguan filler and binders from Brazil and Mexico.
Yep. Going to cut me off there. I see how it is.
Well, you're about to say Nicaragua or binder, Brazilian fillers instead of Nicaraguan. So I just corrected you before you made your mistake.
Correct yourself, because the binder is Brazil and Mexico.
I don't know.
Nicaraguan filler, binders from Brazil and Mexico.
There we go.
Whatever. There's like different countries in this cigar. That's all we're saying. and they say this is probably the closest a smoker can get to a fusion of Cuban craftsmanship and Nicaraguan ingenuity. Yeah. And I got to say, this is a damn good cigar. And one other thing, which I did not know this at the time of purchasing this cigar, but until I started doing some research, they actually have a contest going on with this cigar. So when you pick one of these up, when you remove the label, and we haven't done it yet, so we're not even don't know ourselves until the end of the podcast. But if you find a symbol on the backside of your label, either an H, an HP, or a T, you win a prize. They're giving away some samplers, some full boxes, and a grand prize of a private rolling seminar with Hamlet himself for you and up to 20 guests. So it's runs through April. So go out and pick up some of these if you can find them, and maybe we'll get lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, so far into the first third of the cigar, I'm really digging the flavor profile here. I mean, I would put this at a medium to medium full. You know, with the San Andreas wrapper, there's you know, a touch of spice to it, but it's, you know, definitely not as peppery as, you know, some of the cigars that contain the Lajero fillers and stuff. But it still sports a complex profile. I mean, you know, there's some woody, some nutty, and then the spice coming out of it. I mean, this is, you know, a damn good cigar, in my opinion, you know, and especially for the price point.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an expensive cigar. It's about a $8-$9 smoke, so it's very, very feasible. It's not one of these, like, you know, $20 special editions or anything like that. It's going to be a good regular smoke. So this week we decided to talk about James Bond, and since Spectre just came out, we kind of had to narrow the topic down because there's been 50 years of Bond, 24 movies, 6 different actors. So we decided to break it up into group. So our first, consider this volume one of our James Bond podcast. And, you know, maybe every couple of months we'll drop you another volume. But so we're concentrating on the last four Bond movies. We're going to talk about Daniel Craig's career as Bond this episode.
Yep, absolutely. So stay tuned for the main segment.
Welcome back to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. It's time to get shaken, not stirred, as we talk about the last 10 years of Bond and Mr. Daniel Craig's run to, as the character.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, Daniel Craig's been on Bond for, you know, now a decade.
Like, yeah, I mean, Casino Royale came out in 2006, so, I mean, they were probably started filming in 2005, 2004, something like that. So, yeah, it's been 10 years since. No wonder he's like, fuck this, I'm out.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't know, but I mean, I gotta say, you know, Daniel Craig's Bond, I mean, that's left a memorable impression on me, so.
Yeah, supposedly, as, you know, Spectre was just released, it's, unless something changes, it's gonna be his last Bond, and I can understand, because out of all the Bonds, Daniel Craig's has probably been the most physically active. I mean, he's, and he's also done most of his own stunts in these movies, too. So 10 years of doing that, it's got to take take a toll on the body.
Yeah, I was you know, watching some of the Bond films and everything in preparation for the thing. And I kept looking, like, you know, to see if they digitally enhanced or if, you know, there was a double or something. And a lot of the stuff, no, it was Daniel Craig himself. And I'm like, I can't do that shit at my age.
Yeah. I mean, how old is Daniel Craig?
I mean, he was born in, you know, 1968, and, you know, shout out to him for also having a birth month in March. So,
all cool people are born in March.
Yeah, apparently. So, Aries represent. You know, representing, well, that'd be the Pisces.
Well, I'm an Aries motherfucker, so.
How does that work?
I don't know. We'll look it up after the show.
Because I'm March 10th, and I'm a Pisces, so.
I think it's like late March to like sometime in April is Aries.
Well,
anyway, not the
me and Daniel Craig's only slightly more cooler than you are. Then
you're right. All right, yeah. Let's talk. Daniel Craig's run has kind of been revolutionary as far as Bond goes, because this was, I mean, pretty much. If you look at these movies as a whole, it's a prequel, pretty much. I mean, he is not James Bond at the start of these movies.
No.
I mean, these four movies have really been him becoming James Bond. They did away with all the jokes, really, because, I mean, there's several things you know you're going to get with a James Bond movie, or at least all the previous movies up to this point. You're going to get a femme fatale that has some kind of weird sexual innuendo name, like Pussy Galore or Xena on a Top. You're going to get a shitload of gadgets. You're going to get Q, M, you know, you're going to have him sleeping with a whole bunch of women, which they still hold on to at least some of that. But, you know, I mean, this when they rebooted with Casino Royale.
And let me, you know, slow down, because we've talked about, you know, and you're going to get a badass well-dressed suit. You know, that's the other iconic Bond thing is.
And a martini.
Yes.
Shaken, not stirred.
That if you go to a bar and order, will be like jet fuel.
Bond's a man. After I've you know, ordered the James Bond martini, I'm like, this stuff is strong. How he fights crime after drinking five or six of these, I don't know. He's, like I said, he is the man.
he just blacks out, and you know that's why he disobeys orders and does his own thing so much.
And you know, in our area of expertise, and we're not talking about Roger Moore yet. That'll be a future episode at some point. But I do like when I was looking up Bond facts that Roger Moore had in his contract that he would have unlimited access to Monte Cristo cigars while he was filming.
And that's freaking awesome.
If I ever become a movie star, I'm putting that in my contract.
Yes. Yeah, if nothing else, you know, I may not make shit off this movie, but I'm going to have a lot of good cigars between now and the end of it.
Or if you get a contract like Daniel Craig here, he gets free Aston Martins for life.
Yeah, I mean, that's just to put that in perspective, like, he could pretty much show up at any Aston Martin dealership and be like, yo, I want this car, and it's done.
Yeah, he doesn't even need to own a car anymore. Like, he goes somewhere that has a dealership. He just like, yeah, fly me to wherever has a dealership. I'll just get a pick up a car to drive while I'm here and then leave it behind.
Like, I wonder if there's like a clause that, you know, you are only allowed to, you know, own one model year or something of that at a time. I mean, I don't know.
It's good to be Bond.
So, yeah, I, you know, Bond really put the 1964, you know, DB5 on the map, as tricked out as that thing was.
And that's one thing, and we'll get into it later on. I like about some of the later Daniel Craig movies is they brought back the old Goldfinger Aston Martin.
Yes.
With all the little tricks and gadgets. I mean, just old school as hell.
But still fly as hell. Like, I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, which you and I being car guys, you know, we always, you know, seem to gloat over, you know, the old muscle cars and things of that nature.
And so. I've seen that car, too. There was a, used to be a museum up in Tennessee, and they had the Goldfinger.
Like one of the Goldfinger Star Car Martins. Museums or something?
No, it was like a car museum in Pigeon Forge. And they had, it wasn't Star Cars, it was like a private collection museum or whatever, but he had one of the Goldfinger cars.
That's freaking awesome. Could you, like, see inside the interior, like, see all the cool gizmos?
Oh, yeah,
he
had, it had the little bulletproof plate that popped up in the back and the machine guns that poked out the front. I mean, it was badass. So let's talk about the first movie here real quickly. Casino Royale came out in 2006.
Yeah, you know, we tossed around the idea about doing a poker slash gambling episode. And, you know, I went back and watched this film. And, you know, the fact that this, you know, pretty much takes place with a poker game with a $10 million buy-in, which is absolutely insane.
I mean, that's something Doyle Brunson would be into.
And bluff his ass with the old 7-deuce offsuit, you know.
Because yeah, basically the story of, and that's one thing about, like I said, this movie to me, when it first came out, I was like, until I compared it to the four movies as a set. And that's another thing, as we're saying, that there's so many things that you know about Bond that they changed when Daniel Craig took over. One of them is all the movies are pretty much standalone films. You can pick up anywhere in the series, watch one movie, and you're not confused. Because, like, literally the stories are self-contained and don't really...
Yeah, I mean, they're vastly different.
But with the Daniel Craig ones, they've all been kind of connected.
Yes.
Where, especially Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, which we'll talk about next, Quantum of Solace is a direct sequel to Casino Royale.
Yes.
Which is something they had never done before.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, one of the things. I mean, the whole plot, like you said, you know, for Casino Royale directly, you know, plays into where Quantum of Solace will later on take us. But
yeah, I mean, it was directed by Martin Campbell, and as we always give you the facts and figures here, made for $150 million, made $600 million. I mean, James Bond has been a huge movie since the 60s. I mean, it's like making a James Bond movie is like printing money. You know it's going to make money.
Yes, but it also has a tendency that if you were to F it up somehow, that, you know, critics and everybody are just going to probably not give any movie you were to produce afterwards a chance.
Like, what has George Lazenby done?
Yes.
Which, oddly, it's a good movie, but he's a horrible Bond. And we'll talk about that when we get to that episode in a future episode. But, yeah, Casino Royale, The story of it is, like I said, this is really James Bond's first mission. I mean, you see him earning his 00 at the start of the movie. So it is a true reboot. And like I said, when I first came out, I kind of described it as a good movie, but a bad Bond movie. Because at this point, I'd seen everything that came before it. And Daniel Craig is not really James Bond in this movie. He's like a freaking, SAS assassin.
Well, I mean, you see him essentially, beginning his, 007 career, but, then it flashes back to prior to that, and that's really where the story takes place.
Yeah, I mean, and he's uber violent in this movie. He's emotional. I mean, the first girl he seduces, he pretty much falls in love with her. And, he's definitely not the sophisticated, calculating, cold Bond that all his predecessors have been.
Yes,
you're basically seeing him become that professional. And I mean, the story of the movie is there is basically a banker who takes care of the money of all these terrorist organizations. Like if he knows there's going to be a terrorist attack on some airline, he buys a whole bunch of stock and shorts it, so when that company crashes and their shares crash, all his shares go up. And like I said, that's how he makes money, launders money for all these criminal organizations. But since Bond stopped a terrorist attack on an airplane, dude lost a shitload of money. So now the only way to recoup that loss is to host a $10 million buy-in poker tournament in, was it Morocco or Mogadishu or some
Let's
shit.
See. It is at the Knesset in Montenegro. Yes. Yeah, and that's just insane. I don't know. This is the film that really put, in my opinion, parkour on the map.
Poker had never really been, I would say, at least fully featured as. I mean, you see people playing poker in movies and stuff, but.
Yeah,
a good 50% of that movie takes place at the poker tournament.
The Poker After Dark, the WSOP, all the televised stuff really hadn't taken off. Mainstream.
Yeah, this was kind of the highlight of that World Series of Poker when it became fully mainstream. I mean, this is other than movies that are about actual gamblers. This is the first one that I really treated it seriously. People like us that play Texas Hold'em, I'm like, shit, they're being very real to the game with this tournament.
I mean, that kind of money, I can't take lightly. Too rich for my blood.
Way too rich. And they brought back James Bond's old CIA buddy, Felix Leiter, played by Jeffrey Wright in this movie. And the Bond girl, Eva Green, playing the character of Vesper. So it's like I said, no weird sexualized name in this one.
No, no, because it wasn't until Quantum that we got the introduction. We'll talk about that later on. So yeah, I mean, there's like you said, it's really a precursor to all of that stuff. So I mean, it's
like I said, and also probably one of the most shocking scenes of Casino Royale was the torture scene. You've never seen Bond just get the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's tied up naked in a chair and kicked hitting the nuts repeatedly.
I did that earlier tonight. It was not good.
But it was quite funny.
Granted, I was not naked and tied up in a chair, so.
I mean, seeing someone get hit in the nuts is funny on its own. Seeing someone hit themselves in the nuts, that's like a next level of comedic value.
Hey, in the world of comedy, you got to learn to hate yourself. So that's what makes a good comedian. Hate yourself and then learn to hate your fans.
But yeah, I mean, this is the first Bond you've seen like get hurt. I mean, there's been scenes like in the older films where Bond has been captured, tied up, and sort of tortured, but he always makes it out before any real damage happens to him. But I mean, Daniel Craig's Bond got fucked up. I mean, first he gets poisoned, and then has to
Yeah, poison martini, not good. Not no bueno.
Revive himself.
Yeah, basically defibrillating himself in the car. I mean, which that should speak volumes to how badass Bond is. I mean, could you rightly defibrillate yourself?
Hell no.
Like I could probably utter the words clear and then nothing would happen.
And like, and that's another thing. This movie had, there was really no gadgets. I mean, the only gadget he really had was that defibrillation kit in the, you know, that was in the car. There was no Q. There was no money penny. Like I said, it was just basic Bond. And even, I mean, there's even a scene where he, you know, basically assassinates this bomb maker in front of an embassy. It ends up getting released on the internet and stuff. And M, played by Judi Dench, the only kind of returning actor from some of the previous Bond movies, she like really chews his ass out and is like, you should maybe rethink being a
an agent. Yeah, being an absolutely. Agent.
And I mean, she was like, you know, had lack of forethought, lack of, you know, being subtle, lack of refinement, which is the things you normally associate with Bond. And so I was like, this, when I first saw it, I'm like, this really, I mean, a great action movie, not a Bond film.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
until I looked at it as this being a prequel and he's learning to be Bond. And that made it a whole lot. Looking back now that I've seen four movies, Casino Royale is probably a better film to me now than it was my, you know, first initial reaction.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You know, like you said, a lot of folks went into it anticipating what they have known through, you know, the previous, golly, 20, 30 years of James Bond, and this was not that film. So I don't know, you know, the thing that made this film really stand out to me, you know, was the whole poker playing aspect of it, and then, you know, kind of there toward the end where, you know, he, you know,
kind of the origin of the martini too. I mean, yep. You kind of saw that,
you know, and he stands over Mr. White there at the end of the film and says, you know, the name's James Bond.
Yeah. You know, I'd say that scene there, that was the first time in the movie that he looked like and acted like Bond.
Yes.
Like I was like, all right, the transformation is complete. He is now Bond, because turns out, Vesper is, secretly betrays Bond because supposedly she has a boyfriend, husband, whoever he is, that has been captured by this some kind of organization.
I mean, basically she's been, you know,
forced to betray,
you know,
him,
being
by this,
blackmailed by Quantum,
by this person called Mr. White, and of course Bond hunts him down, and you see him like snipe the guy in the leg and then walk up and he's like, yeah, we need to talk. Yes. And he's like, Bond, James Bond. He's wearing this immaculate suit with the gun and everything. And I'm like, all right, now he's
now
Bond.
Now he's Bond, yes. So I think that, you know, leads us very well into Quantum of Solace.
Which had a badass soundtrack. That's another thing you always see in the James Bond movies. There's always that cool opening music video. For every James Bond movie has like a cool opening song.
And I like the way that they always kind of do the intro credits and stuff like that, too. I mean, you get like a short snippet, the badass music video, the credits, and then, you know, it hits the ground running.
Yeah. And Quantum of Solace is probably, of the four movies, is my favorite opening theme song. And it, like I said, it basically picks up right where the first one left off. I mean, James Bond has captured Mr. White and is bringing him to see M. And he is like I said, this version of Bond is emotional, you know, and violent, unlike, you know, the other Bonds. So he's like straight out for, this is like a vengeance movie. He's out to get the people who caused Vesper to die.
Yes.
And, you know, turned her against him.
Yeah, this is very much a revenge flick. So, you know, you will pay for your shortcomings in life. But yeah, I think it's kind of funny, you know, with freaking Mr. White being driven around in the trunk of his car.
Who turns out M's assistant or whatever turns and tries to kill them, and he gets away. And when they start researching what happened to M's assistant, they find that he also had a loved one that was supposedly captured by this organization that we don't know who it is yet. So it's kind of mirrors the whole what happened with Vesper. And so Bond is like, these people are behind it. It's time to kill a mofo.
Yep, absolutely. I mean,
plus you don't mess with M.
No, don't fuck with M.
The great Dame Judi Dench. I mean, she will fuck you up.
Yes. And it doesn't matter if she's fucked up herself. Like, she's still going to come out on top.
So, Bond goes after this organization that is supposedly behind La Chief, which was the bad guy from the last movie, and all that, by the name of Quantum, which basically, it's their whole deal is they are buying up water rights to this country and shutting off the water supply. They're basically damming up all these underground water sources.
Yep.
So the country is forced to buy water from them.
At a much higher price.
Yeah, it's like a very...
True espionage.
Yeah, it's a very Bond villain-esque plot. You know, the weird, like, you know, grandiose, you know, we're taking over the world plot line that that you know to love.
Yeah, like you said, this is the film where Bond really kind of starts feeling like Bond, and a lot of the things that we've known over the previous years, you know, really start to come into fruition.
And this is also one of the most violent Bond movies, with a body count of 250 people are killed in this movie. The most deaths in a Bond movie ever.
Damn. Yeah, I mean, I think, what, the next highest is like 150-something deaths or 136 deaths, something like that.
Something like that. That might have been Spectre. I don't know. But just for comparison, Dr. No, the original James Bond movie, there was 109 deaths in that movie. So, yeah, he definitely ramped it up for this one. Also, made for $200 million, made $586 million. This one was directed by Mark Foster, starring Daniel Craig, Olga Kurylenko as the Bond girl for this this movie, who is basically the head of Quantum, Dominic Green. This girl is kind of undercover trying to get, she's a Bolivian, agent who, and that's the country that Quantum's trying to seize control of their water supply. And also her father, I think, was murdered by this general that Quantum is trying to support to take over the country. They're like, basically like, we'll give you control of this country as long as you buy water from us.
Yeah, and I, you know, talking about, you know, the freaking Bolivian fighter, the scene where the freaking, you know, they get shot down by the fighter jet and skydive from the burning plane into the freaking sinkhole.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
You know, while the plane's, like, falling above them. Yes. Probably one of the most insane big action scenes.
Yeah, I mean,
scenes.
That's like, you know, I'm just... You know, most people do good to jump out of a plane and land on their feet.
That's the thing, you know, if this had been like, you know, Roger Moore or something, he would have done it without even breaking a sweat, still in the immaculate tuxedo. You know, this Bond actually gets dirty.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that, you know, brings a bit of realism, you know, into the Bond thing. I mean... You know, to have a character that's seemingly almost invincible, you know, this puts it into retrospect that, hey, he's human after all, so...
And this was, like, the third highest grossing James Bond movie of all time. So it definitely made some money. And that's the other thing cool about these Bond movies. If they've really been worldwide productions, it's not like, you know, everything's filmed in you know, Canada and made to look like 50 different countries. No, if they're in Italy, they're in Italy. If they're in France, they're in France.
Yeah, I mean, that's and I think that's another thing about the Bond films that we really didn't touch on is you're going to see worldwide travel. Like, you know, there's just not one central location, city, or country.
Yeah.
They're all over the freaking world.
Yeah, these have always been made to look... It's not like a small, isolated plot. No, these are all worldwide conspiracies, you know, these are very far-reaching stuff with global impact. You know, Bond is literally saving the world, not just England.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, makes Bond so relatable. I don't know. I mean, just some of the scenery and stuff like that. Like you said, you know, when they're in Italy, you're seeing Italy and vice versa.
Oh, and like I said, this was one where Bond kind of has to go rogue, as we've seen in some of the earlier films, because everyone thinks this, what's his name, the guy who's running Quantum.
Oh, Isn't Yousef? Oh man, it was right there on the tip of my tongue. Damn it! I
don't know. I'll keep talking. You look for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, everybody thinks he's this. He's supposed to be like some serious Greenpeace guy fighting deforestation and whatnot. But yeah, he. You know, it turns out this guy is the bad guy. But everyone thinks he's so they have to kind of disavow him. And M's like, if something's up, find proof. I'll support you. Yeah, and kind of covers for Bond as he goes rogue. Cause,
was it Dominic Green?
I think that is that is the character I was looking for. But yeah, and I say the big final battle or whatever takes place in one of the most interesting locations in a Bond film. It's a hotel in the middle of the desert that's completely run
the
on
Atacama
like
desert.
Yeah. And it's run, it's all powered by hydrogen. It's like some kind of weird, like hydrogen powered hotel that, of course, anyone who knows anything about chemistry, hydrogen's a very volatile and explosive substance, which is definitely going to play into effect as Bond blows up the whole fucking hotel.
And that's the other thing about Bond, is you're going to get some badass explosions.
Because real men don't look at explosions.
Yes.
They just blow it up and walk away, as the song tells us.
Yeah, so basically, once the hotel blows up, we see Bond capture Green and interrogate him, into learning all of the inner workings of Quantum.
But we also get another MI6 agent sent to follow Bond, who, of course, there's always, you've seen a Bond film, and they brought back this trope for this movie, because as these four films progress, they slowly start adding back Bondisms. And one of them is, there's always two Bond girls. There's the one he sleeps with at the first of the movie who ends up getting killed, and then there's the main character, Bond girl. So we're introduced to...
You always gotta have a backup, I guess,
Yeah. We're introduced to Strawberry Fields. So they not as... sexual as some of the previous Bond girl names, but we're starting to get more of that playfulness.
Yes. Yeah, you start seeing some of the light humor come to light.
And like I said, this one being a direct sequel, it was, like I said, people who saw this without seeing the first one was like a little bit confused, because normally Bond movies are just standalone
independent features. Yep.
And that brings us probably to my favorite of the Daniel Craig series, Skyfall, which came out in 2012.
Yes. Yeah, this was, the 23rd James Bond film. This also had the intro, which the intro to this song was an Academy Award-winning theme
By
Adele, yep.
Directed by Sam Mendes, starring, of course, Daniel Craig, Javier Bardem, Ralph Fiennes as... basically the new M, or he will be M at some point, because this is Dame Judi Dench's last Bond film. Naomi Harris is introduced in this film, who we don't find out who she is until the end of the movie. Now, this movie starts off with Bond trying to rescue a injured agent who eventually is killed. And they're going after this terrorist who has stolen basically the list of every undercover operative worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, basically everything from all the NATO states, essentially.
And Bond's partner in this film, Naomi Harris, Bond's fighting this guy on the roof of a train, and she's ordered to take the shot and accidentally shoots Bond.
Yep.
Who falls off a train into some water, and basically everyone thinks he's dead.
Yeah, you assume he's dead.
He decides this is going to be a good time to retire. And it's a funny thing. People, was it Heineken? got like, because Bond movies have always been big on product placement. You've always had, most of the films, except for the, some other films where BMW was the main car, Aston Martin, certain suit producers, but, Heineken wanted to be the official beer of Bond. But it's funny, the only times you see him drinking Heineken are at his lowest moments, like when he's like washed up hiding on some Bahama island.
Well, I mean, you fast forward to Heineken and their marketing today, where, kind of the most interesting man in the world type thing, right? So you know.
The only time you Bond's either when he Bond's
you can't compete with Bond.
When Bond's on top, he's drinking the martinis. But when he's in his low moments, he's like, I just want to have a beer. just want to be a regular dude.
I want that natural skunky taste that Heineken brings. Yeah. But you know, still, I'm not going to take a knock on Heineken because it is decent beer.
Oh yeah, it's not my flavor. So, someone who actually blows up at the MI6 headquarters, which that's the agency Bond works for. So Bond comes back from his kind of retirement to
go to Scotland.
He's like they've killed his buddies, so he's got to come back and he's like he's not Bond at the start of it. He's injured, still injured from getting shot. He's kind of almost suffering from PTSD. He's definitely not on top of his game. And you kind of see that at the start of the movie where he's back in the field and is just kind of not all there.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I just think it's crazy, like the intelligence aspect of this. That was one thing that, you know, being an IT background and stuff like that, this is probably one of my favorite films from that aspect.
It was the highest grossing film in the UK, highest grossing film in the series, and the highest grossing film worldwide. This has probably been, like they said, the hugest of the new Bond films, if hugest is even a word. But we also get reintroduced, or as you find out at the end of the film, Naomi Harris's character, which Bond never knew her name. And when he comes back, she's kind of been demoted from a field agent because she couldn't handle it after she thought she killed Bond, so she kind of becomes M's secretary, and we find out her name is Moneypenny. So they reintroduce the character of Moneypenny in this film. And they also reintroduce the character of Q.
Yes.
Which it's kind of funny when they finally meet each other in this and he's like super young too. Q has always been like kind of like this older statesman giving Bond advice. Now he's like this freaking hacker kid. But he goes to bring Bond his equipment, and you've always known Bond and Q for badass gadgets, and all he gives him is a gun and a micro radio. He's like, what else do you need? And they kind of make jokes to the previous films. He's like, I brought you your gear, and he's like a gun and a radio. And he's like, what'd you expect, an exploding pen?
Yes. That's awesome.
But yeah, Bond eventually, and you eventually find out the bad guy is a former 00 agent of some kind who was abandoned by MI6. I mean, because in any spy organization, if you're captured, you're disavowed. And Raul Silva, played by Javier Bardem, and Ben Whishaw, who played Q. But yeah, Raul is basically out for vengeance on MI6 and M personally. And pretty much this whole thing of them losing the spy list, MI6 get blown up. There's pressure from the government for M to retire, and they kind of send in Ralph Fiennes' character to oversee the transition and the end of her career. And then this whole fight kind of turns personal, where now they're coming after M herself, and Raoul's trying to kill her. So Bond kind of goes off the grid, dishes everything, and probably one of the most badass moments goes to like this old garage, because they're like, we need, we stole your car is tracked. It's a government car, so we need something we can go off the grid in. And he pulls out the old Goldfinger 60s.
Yeah, this is where you see the 64, DB5 make its appearance.
And they flee to Bond's family home in Scotland called Skyfall, where we get the title of the movie. if you haven't seen this, Bond is able to take out the bad guys as always, but unfortunately, Dame Judi Dench's character is killed in action, and Ralph Fiennes takes over as the new M.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know, man. I want to talk a little bit about, once they arrive to Skyfall and stuff, like, when the freaking attack chopper shows up, that shit is insane. Like, that's really where you see, the freaking, I don't know if it was machine guns or like semi-automatic shotguns, you know, that appear. But, you know, he's able to, Bond's able to wipe out a couple of the guys that emerge from the copter. But, you know, later on, like, they completely freaking booby trap Skyfall, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah, because since Bond has supposedly been dead, no one owned the home. So they, you know, auctioned off. Someone bought the entire gun collection. So really, there's just a couple like hunting shotguns left and Bond's pistol, and that's pretty much all the weapons they have to defend themselves. So it gets real MacGyverish. Building improvised landmines.
I mean,
out of shotgun
you're
shells,
seeing them freaking, yeah, you know,
filling light bulbs full
shells
of gunpowder to build explosives. And M, is this the first time you've really seen her like out in the field? And now you know why she's the head of MI6. She's like a total badass in this film.
Yeah, I mean, her downfall, you know, the foreshadowing to her death is, you know, where she goes to take the shot after a couple of guys break in, and she misses the shot, inadvertently getting shot herself. And you see Bond, you know, able to take out the guys and basically tells, you know, everybody to...
Not a winner.
Damn it. So Joe has taken the wrapper off of his cigar at this point, and breaking news... That was not a... So, we still got one more wrapper to go.
But yeah, I like seeing kind of Bond's origins, like where he came from. I mean, this was a kid of privilege, really. I mean, this was a pretty... You know, if his parents hadn't have died in a car accident or whatever the background story is.
I mean, it was a very affluent family.
Yeah, like he would have been like your typical rich kid, but no, he was orphaned and became a soldier.
And I have removed the label from my cigar as well. Not a winner.
All right, we'll have to buy more of these and keep trying. If you do win, you know, send us an email. Let us know. But yeah, and Raul Silva is just a creepy-ass Bond villain.
Yeah, I mean, he's, for all intent and purposes, like, I mean, to put the creepiness in perspective, like, you know, once they retreat to the cathedral, basically, you know, he arrives and, you know, basically tries to convince M to take them both out and, you know, basically places his head on her shoulder with the freaking pistol.
Like, yeah, he's like,
you know, just pull the trigger, you know, end
yeah,
us both.
He's like, to kill me, kill yourself. Yeah, just, yeah. I mean, it's so weird.
And then you just hear the thud and, you know, that's Bond throwing the knife in his back, like...
And to take it back earlier in the movie, there's that whole scene where Bond, of course, does the Bond thing and seduces a girl to find out information on the big bad, and eventually gets captured by Raoul. So they have this this contest. Basically, they William Tell her. They put like a freaking shot of scotch on her head, and it's like with these like old single action like muzzle loader pistols, and it's like, all right, you know, if you want her to live, shoot the shot glass off her head. And you know, like I said, Bond is at this point not fully healed from his previous debacle and misses. So when it's, you know, Raoul's turn, he just shoots her in the head. And of course you start seeing more of that coldness of Bond. He's like, you ruined a perfectly good scotch.
Yes.
So doesn't care about the girl.
Doesn't even care about the girl.
You spilled the scotch, man. What the hell? Now I know you're evil.
Yes. The girl can be replaced. The scotch, not so much.
I was like, I got five more of those at the hotel waiting on me. That was a good bottle of scotch. So, what were your thoughts on Skyfall?
I mean, out of the series, I think Skyfall is probably my favorite film to date. You know, just because you start seeing Bond kind of coming more into his elements and things of that nature, plus just the action and stuff that this film brought. I mean, you know, Bond freaking taking down the attack helicopter by freaking blowing up Skyfall, and then, you know, later on after he escapes the burning building, he's basically on the lake of ice and, you know, gets confronted by a security guard with a automatic rifle and basically takes the rifle and cuts a hole in the ice And, you know, the underwater battle scene there was just freaking awesome.
Yeah. That too, and, you know, he ends up taking out a bunch of the guys with the machine guns from the DB-8. I mean, it's the car from the original James Bond. I mean, it's got all the weapons and everything, which was one of the coolest aspects of it. That it
that was one of the things. Is this film alluded, you know, to some of the previous films, which I thought was cool. You know, this one, like you said, is a little bit tougher to come into. You know, if you don't know the history of Quantum and what led up to this this version, but. You know, I think this is probably my favorite film so far.
And then we get to the most recent release. This year's Spectre. Which, anyone who's a fan of the Bond series, Spectre was the big bad organization that was always after Bond in the previous movies.
Yeah, I mean, this film had a lot of throwbacks to the previous Bonds, but... You know, did you know this film was one of the most expensive films ever made?
Really? I mean, it was made for like, the budget was like $300 million.
$245 million.
Yeah, and it so far, and it's still in theaters, so it's still making money. I mean, it's already made $792 million as of this printing.
That is just insane.
And, of course, stars Daniel Craig, Christoph Waltz, who... He was an awesome bad guy, and he's the creepy German dude from Inglourious Basterds. He was also in Django Unchained. I mean, he's a really great actor.
Yes.
And this one, Ralph Fiennes, has been promoted. He is now M. He is in charge of MI6. But, and from here on out, spoiler alert, if you've not seen Spectre yet, go ahead and skip ahead to Beer 30. but in this one, there is a new... organization trying to kind of take over, and they want to do away with the 00 program. They're going to basically a drone electronic surveillance platform. They want all countries to turn over all surveillance stuff to this central organization and kind of do away with actual human intelligence. And, you know, Ralph Fiennes has a great line where he's like, License to Kill is important because a drone knows when to pull a trigger, but only a person knows when to not pull a trigger. They said it's not about, you know, killing people. It's having that judgment to like, all right, should I or shouldn't I? You know, am I going to get more intelligence if I, you know, don't kill this person?
Yes.
And that's something that you really have to. It takes a professional to make
that character split conflict, decisions. Yeah. You know, another previous note that I thought was interesting about this film is even though it wasn't shot in IMAX using IMAX cameras, it was only the second film of the Bond series to actually have an IMAX screening.
Oh, sweet.
So Skyfall was shown on IMAX, but Spectre was the second of the series.
And I got to say, the opening sequence of Bond in Mexico at a Day of the Dead celebration so epic. And I love the fact that when you see the Day of the Dead parade, there's these giant 20-foot-tall skeleton puppets that are smoking big-ass cigars. I was like, damn right.
And always looking for that Stogie reference.
Yeah. And you also start to see more of the Bondisms, because I mean, there's a scene where Bond is trying to take out this character, guy's in a meeting with some terrorists trying to sell some weapons or something. So when Bond takes the shot, a bomb goes off and blows up this building. The building falls down, pretty much knocks down the building Bond is on, and he kind of falls through all the floors, lands on a couch. And then kind of just like adjusts his tie, like, well, that was exciting. I mean, that's something you would see like previous Bonds doing. Like, the dude does not get excited anymore. And like I said, and that whole opening shot from him going into the hotel, it can't be like a single shot, but it almost looks like a single shot where the camera just is kind of following him through that whole segment up to where he takes the shot. And I was like, that's, as a fan of cinematography, that was like very cool.
Yeah, the way they shot that.
They shot that scene. And then you get this badass fight scene in a helicopter over this crowd of, like, probably a couple hundred thousand people.
Yeah, the whole, you know, Bond having to fight a helicopter. I mean, that's a recurring theme in quite a few of the movies. Like, And I don't know. I mean, like, from a video game aspect, I think that's always one of the greatest moments when you as a, you know, human character or, you know, freaking pit against a full-on gunship or something like that. Like, yeah, it's always a, yes, I made it.
Yeah, I mean, and the having a fist fight in the back of a helicopter is just probably insane. But also this character who Bond kills, we find out shortly after that this was not a sanctioned hit from MI6. Bond is acting on his own, and he gets pretty much suspended by M in the midst of all this because it's
for disobeying the orders.
It's like a huge international incident that buildings are blown up, people were killed. And then you find out that once, Bond kind of tells Moneypenny what's really going on, is Dame Judi Dench's character appears as she left a tape and was like, if you are seeing this video, that means I'm dead. And I have one final mission for you. Find, I believe his name was Franz Oberhauser. Find Oberhauser and kill him. And don't miss the funeral. So basically, as we later find out, there's some kind of secret organization called Spectre, led by Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
And apparently, Judi Dench knew about this, the previous M. And, this shadow group has been behind. I mean, it's got things in the government. It turns out all these previous bad guys that have been trying to kill Bond all worked for Spectre.
Yes.
And it links all four of the movies together. All these things that have happened, it's really been Spectre behind it. And it's just like shadow government that no one knows about. So Bond really doesn't know who he can trust except for his friends, Moneypenny, and of course Q, which even Q's character, it's kind of bringing back that original Bond stuff. Like I said, all these movies can be kind of seen as a prequel because now you see, because even Q doesn't trust people anymore. So he's built his own little private base where he can experiment with gadgets and whatnot. And we also see way more gadgets in this film. He gives Bond a watch. He's like, what does it do? He's like, it tells time, of course, but it also has a very loud alarm. Wink, wink. And basically, like, he injects Bonds with these, like, nano trackers, so now he can't go off on his own anymore. They can track him wherever he wants. He's like, all right, Q, help me disappear. I have something I have to do. He's like, all right, I'll tell them all that it takes 48 hours for them to come active, so I'll give you 48 hours to do whatever you got. And builds, like, a badass new Bond mobile, a new Aston Martin, which was supposed to go to Bond, but now since he's been demoted, it's going to go to like 009, but Bond steals it anyway.
It's like,
because he's Bond.
Yeah.
Why not? He does. And we also see, is when he tracks down Spectre, they're having this very shadowy meeting. And it's probably one of the coolest scenes in the movie because everybody's kind of, the leader's kind of blacked out and like they're in this room with like, the lower-ranking people are all up on balconies watching, and you see Batista from Guardians of the Galaxy and wrestling show up as like, and they're like, all right, since Oberhauser is dead, I need somebody to take over his part of the organization. Who wants to do it? And this other guy's like, sitting at the table, it's like, I will take over his mission. And I'm like, all right, is there anybody who objects to this? And freaking Batista steps out of the crowd.
Just steps in, does what he does.
Yeah, and they're like, all right, what's your qualifications for replacing, him over this other guy, and doesn't say a word. He just reaches down and gouges the guy's eyeballs out with his bare hands and then drops him and sits down in his chair. He's like, all right, you get the position.
Position granted. Yeah, I think that was probably one of my favorite highlights of this film.
But then when he turns and starts talking to Bond, I mean, Bond thinks he's being sneaky and just hanging out in the crowd, and the guy turns like, so James, you finally made it. That was like, you're like, oh fuck. Yeah. Bond's in trouble.
It was completely staged from the word go.
And it turns out this guy played by Christoph Waltz, let me find what his character's name is, but it turns out to be basically Bond's adopted brother, because after Bond's parents were killed, he was adopted by this family that's Oberhauser. My bad. I can't remember what the first guy he killed is called, but, it's basically the Bond's adoptive parents were killed who were skiers in a avalanche. So they think the whole family's dead, but secretly this guy has been running Spectre this whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this film was absolutely sweet. I mean, I enjoyed this film thoroughly, and I like the fact that it alluded and really tied all the other films together.
Yeah, that, and you find out that Mr. White from the first two movies are kind of, he's kind of grown to conscience and left Spectre and is in hiding. So Bond has to go find him to find out all the stuff about Spectre. And he's like, I have a daughter. I will give you the information you need to stop them. Just protect my daughter. So Bond goes to find her, and they go to this clinic that's up on top of a mountain, which is basically the same clinic from on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where you see George Lazenby's Bond. So yeah, there's that reference to the old Bonds.
Yeah, and Christoph Waltz, he was Ernest.
Yeah, that's revealed later.
Yeah,
well, I can't remember what his
Well, originally it was going to be Franz.
Franz Oberhauser was his name. But like I said, we'll get to who he's revealed to be here in a minute. But you see him at this. You know, he goes to find her at this this clinic, which, like I said, has appeared in, and it looks like the same building even that they shot that original Bond film, and so that's another cool flashback. And then we also get to see Q in the field in this movie, which, you know, every once in a while Q would show up in the old Bond movies while Bond's out in the field and help him out. So it was cool to see him back into the world with gadgets and whatnot.
Yes, absolutely.
But eventually, you know, Bond gets the girl and goes after Franz, and they track him to this probably the most badass Bond villain hideout, which is in the middle of a crater in this desert. And turns out this guy is the one secretly behind this joint intelligence task force, and he wants to control the world's information, because, you know, he that controls all the information controls the world. And in typical Bond villain fashion, ties Bond to this torture chair and starts trying to erase parts of his memory by drilling into his head and doing crazy shit. So, and in the first scene where you see him in this white torture room, and the guy has a big fluffy white cat, I'm like, oh fuck, I know that cat.
Yes.
And that's when he's like, Franz Oberhauser is dead. You may call me Ernest Blofeld, which was the bad guy that was always after Bond in the previous movies.
Yep.
They finally, like I said, that surprise that, oh shit, this is Spectre, this is Blofeld, we're back to old school Bond.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing that, like I said, you know, the precursors to the previous films and everything, that's what made Spectre such an awesome film for me.
And of course, Bond escapes and typical Bond fashion by using a gadget and blowing shit up, which... And the character of... what is her name? Dr. Madeleine Swann, played by Leah Sardo, is basically the perfect match to Bond. I mean, she's a daughter of an assassin, so she probably understands Bond better than anyone he knows up to this point. I mean, this is the perfect girl for him to, you know, fall in love with, which, if they continued that character in other Bond films, would probably end badly for her. Anyone who has seen On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where Bond gets married and his wife is killed, this could very easily become the new Mrs. Bond that does not make it past the next film.
Yeah, that's, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, critics actually, you know, didn't like about this film, is with the introduction of so many of these characters, they really didn't do a whole lot of, you know, backstory or anything on them. So you're just kind of like, what's going on here a little bit? And seemed like it was a little bit incomplete as some of the negative feedback the film received.
But Christoph Waltz as Blofeld was...
Oh, that was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you could understand what this guy was like. He's almost better than Bond. I mean, he has the best line. He's like, I've been the author of your pain, or the orchestrator of your pain, or something like that, where basically all the bad things that have happened to you, all your friends that have died, it's been me the whole time. And that, I mean, that is just the most badass villain line, in, at least in these four Bond movies.
Yes. Yeah, I really hope that, you know, with Spectre's success and everything else, that I would like to see a successful, you know, 007 video game be released.
Yeah. I mean, and if they can, I mean, he does not die in this movie too, so even if Daniel Craig doesn't return and they do continue, because of course there's going to be a new Bond movie, we just don't know who the new Bond is, there's the opportunity for Blofeld and Spectre to return and continue to be a thorn in Bond's side, you know, like it used to be back in the day. That's why I like, when I said, when you put these movies together, it kind of view it as a prequel of the previous Bond movies. And at the end of it, when it's all said and done, and we also get to see M in the field being a badass, Bond goes to see M, and it's that office from the very first Bond movie with the quilted leather door and Moneypenny's office just outside the door. It's basically like this movie ends almost where Dr. No begins.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know, man. I'm really curious to see what the future of the Bond franchise and everything holds, and to see where that goes.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. See what we get next out of this. So as we wrap this up, what are your thoughts on the cigar?
My thoughts on the cigar is the spiciness, toned down as I got further into it, and it took on more of a smoother note. I mean, it was quite pleasant, actually. I mean, the way that it transitioned, with this film or with the cigar and everything, I mean, it's just been absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, this is probably one of my new favorite Rocky cigars. So what have you thought of, Daniel Craig compared to our previous Bonds?
I mean, I think Daniel Craig as, it's the epitome of Bond. I mean, Daniel Craig is probably the guy that's going to have the lasting memories, on Bond. I don't know. We'll see what happens after Spectre and stuff like that, but I don't know, man. I don't know that Bond's going to have the same feeling and everything. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's... Like I said, the thing I've liked about these four movies, it's really showed... This has been a Bond origin story. Like I said, he was that rookie assassin at the start, and by the end of this movie, he is the Bond you know and love from all previous, films and iterations. And like I said, now we have our big bad guy of Blofeld in the mix. And like I said, that final scene with them in the office, I'm like, holy shit, this is the beginning of the next Bond movie. Yeah. young Sean Connery is about to walk in the door.
So, talking future Bond, I mean, is there an actor that comes to mind that you think would make a really good Bond that you would like to see, or?
I don't know. There's been a lot of rumors. Some people have been what's the guy's name from The Wire, and he was also in, I believe he was in the Pacific Rim.
Oh, shit. I know who you're talking about. The guy's name slipped my mind.
But he was also in a Thor movie. There's been some rumors that he could be Bond. What's the name that plays Loki? I mean, or even we go Doctor Who and Matt Smith. I mean,
ooh, Matt Smith as a Bond. That would be freaking awesome.
Or even David Tennant. I mean, he's been excellent on Jessica Jones as Kilgrave. I can see him suiting up and being Bond. I mean, he is Scottish. It would work.
Absolutely.
All right. And I think that'll about wrap up our Bond talk. We'll be right back with some Beer 30.
Stay tuned.
It's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. It's Beer 30, yo.
Yeah, we got a very interesting brew on tap this time.
Oh, I'm kind of...
In fact, it's so interesting, we haven't even managed to take a sip of it yet.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to this.
I don't know, man. I guess to start out with, we got to tell folks what the hell we're drinking. So we picked up a bottle of Abita Bad Mother Shucker, and this thing is supposed to be brewed with oysters.
Yeah, it's an oyster stout.
So, I got to say, man, as far as the stout goes, like just as far as the clarity and stuff of this, like, I mean, this looks almost like a dark brown ale or something. I mean, it doesn't pour black as the Ace of Spades like I'm used to the traditional stout.
I'm smelling, you know, like a coffee stout smell, but all right, here we go. Let's try this bastard.
I gotta say, it's not bad.
Not as bad as I thought it was gonna be.
I mean, so, you know, I'm picking up some notes of caramel, some notes of chocolate. I mean, you know, as far as a stout goes, I mean, you know, it tastes like a stout. Like, I'm picking up maybe just a tad bit of saltiness on the back end. Maybe that's where the oyster... Yeah.
It's brewed with pale caramel, roasted, and chocolate malts. And it's hopped up with Williamette hops, balanced out with sweet and full flavor of oats. Fresh Louisiana oysters are added to the brew in the final stages, infusing a slight taste of sea salt that offsets the sharpness of the stout. See, I'm definitely tasting that little bit of salt, but I was afraid it was going to be like just freaking like drinking fish juice. You know,
yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Big fishy taste to it, but I mean, I really didn't pick that up on the first couple sips.
Yeah, I mean, just reading the description now, you know, of course, we did just grab the beer out of the fridge, so I'd be curious as to, you know, what flavors emerge once this starts warming up a little bit. But I mean, I gotta say, for a...
It's definitely not vegan for all you hippies out there.
Yeah, I mean, for a $5 bomber, I mean, I'm not disappointed. In fact, I'm slightly surprised. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, just... Yeah, I wanted to hate it, but it's it's not as scary as I thought it would be.
I mean, if you poured this into a glass and didn't tell anybody what the heck they were drinking, they'd just be like, oh, that's pretty decent stout you got yourself there. I mean, especially at the price point. Like, I don't know. I'm pleasantly surprised. I'm kind of like you. Like, I wanted it to almost be like a gag beer, you know? We tried the Sriracha beer, and neither one of us were fans of that.
We still got to try the Crime and Punishment beer.
I don't know. I'm curious. I did find a beer that's brewed with ghost pepper, so I'd be curious to try that.
Well, was it the... I saw the liquor store. I haven't picked one up yet, but Stone has made a beer set called Crime and Punishment. I can't remember what the crime one is, but Punishment is the double bastard with chili peppers.
Oh, I bet that would be awesome.
So it's their Imperial Stout with chili peppers added. And I can't remember what the other... I think the crime is a Lucky Bastard with chili peppers in it. So yeah, that's one I definitely want to try. But I mean, it's not bad. What do you rate this one?
You know, perception wise, I wanted to rate it a 2, but now that I've tried it, I mean, I think I'm at like a 4.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good.
I mean, I am noticing that as the beer starts to warm up a little bit now. I am getting more of that salty note, like almost like a I don't know, it's hard to describe it. Like going to the
salted
beach
caramel.
And you can kind of taste the salt in the air a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm kind of getting that, you know, taste out of it, but
it's almost like a salted caramel flavor.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing off-putting or nothing fishy or oystery about it. I mean, like, in fact, I'd be okay with, you know, some oysters on the half shell, you know, a little hot sauce, and, you know, I think it can make an awesome combination. So.
All right, and with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Yes, science! And we're back with science! You ready to learn some shit, Brad?
Fuck yeah, man.
All right. You know, I kind of, it's not a nerd nerd science segment without bartender. Fuck.
Are you ready to talk about this science segment?
I'm so excited. No, it's I have to bring in a robot story, you know, and confirm our eventual, you know, robot apocalypse. But now there's...
We bow down to our robot overlords.
Yes, exactly. robot bartenders. We did a story previously about robot bartenders at one point. But there's a problem because robots cannot detect the subtle social signals that humans give off that are, you know, that most of us take for granted and quite easily, you know, understand each other. But for a robot, that's something that they're not, they can't pick up on beyond, you know, explicit verbal communication. So they have been working on breaching the human machine communications barrier by training robot bartenders to better understand the science behind ordering a drink.
What is said science?
Well, like I said, they've developed this robot they're calling James, a good bartender name, to decipher the unspoken communications between humans and customers. And basically, they use what they're calling a ghost in the shell concept, where basically a human bartender can see through the robot's eyes, but not actually interact with the customers. And based on what they're seeing, decide what reactions the robot should have to the data that it's receiving. For one thing, they noticed that where a bartender can kind of prioritize the information coming in, the robot kind of prioritizes things equally. So they were not able to communicate with the person when they turn away to make the drinks. Like, when they're not facing the person, speaking directly to the person, they lose communication when they turn away, where a normal bartender can keep the conversation going while he's got his back turned mixing the drinks, or can, you know, tell when someone's like, just kind of like, you know, nod or wave or, you know, whatever, just cue, you know, unspoken cue to, hey, dude, I need another drink.
Money on the counter is usually a good one. Money on the counter with eye contact.
Yeah, this experiment was being run by the Battlefield University Cluster of Excellence in Cognitive Interaction Technology. Yeah, that's a lot of words.
Does it have a cool acronym?
BUCKECKY. I don't know. Anyway, Sebastian Loth is the lead scientist on this project, and this is not only, you know, getting robots to pick up on social cues and nonverbal communication. This stuff has implications in other forms of robot human action. So even though it's being based in this scenario of, hey, serve me a drink, Terminator, it can be used in other, you know, future, you know, interactions with robots.
That's pretty awesome. Like, I've seen some of the videos of, you know, some of the robot mixologists in action, and I mean, that's one of the things I like about going to a bar, and you have a good, you know, mixologist there that, you know, very personable, some of the bar tricks and, you know, showmanship that goes along with that. And, you know, it just turns into a complete spectacle while you're ordering your drink.
Yeah. And basically, like, what the ghost determined is the robot's got to learn to be able to actually ignore some data and, you know, prioritize what's more important to pay attention to. So, like I said, they can talk to them without, you know, having to be face-to-face with the person they're dealing with. You know, and of course, they got to teach them to be able to listen to your problems and, you know, commiserate with you, as all good bartenders do.
Bartender is just, you know, an underpaid psychologist.
Psychologist without a degree. All right. And continuing in robot news. I mean, I think robot news is going to end up being its own segment at some point. scientists are working on something they call the Walkman robot. And we're not talking about the crappy 80s headphone radios.
What do you mean crappy? Dude, that was probably the thing that, you know, kept me from suicide or something, you know?
Oh,
it's what you had before iPods came around.
Yes. Yes, kids, back in the day.
I mean, that thing had AM, FM, and cassette, dude. Like, come on.
Oh, you had a good one. Mine just had cassette.
I mean, I had one of the ones that just had the radio. It was like a headset radio and did not have a cassette. That was the, I think it was like the original Walkman, which, yeah, was not very good. But this Walkman robot built by the Italian Institute of Technology with Nico Tussagario, if I'm pronouncing that even close to right, basically the problem with robots built for dangerous environments or, like I said, health and safety stuff or disaster recovery is what they're working toward. As you've seen, like the, say, like the police bomb robots and stuff, basically it's like a mini tank with a robotic arm. It's hard for them to interact with the environment because the environment is built for people, you know, things with two legs, two arms, walking upright. I mean, they can't even really open a doorknob. I mean, they're going to have to, like, bash the door in half the time. Or, you know, you've seen these things try to climb upstairs or, you know, somebody run away up a ladder. It's going to be hard for these little tank bots to follow them around. Even with drones, you know, it's hard for a drone to fly around inside a house. So basically what they are building is something that resembles, at least in function, a human being. I mean, walks on 2 feet, has hands with fingers. It has a stereo vision, like human eyes, and a 3D laser scanner to scan its environment. But the thing with this is, let's say you have a robot for fire department or whatever. The tools that a fireman would use, like the jaws of life, cutters, crowbars, all that stuff, that would have to be built into a non-humanoid robot. But with this, since these things are built like humans, can actually pick up and use human tools, human vehicles, climb ladders, balance itself when it's walking across, you know, because that's one thing with other four-legged robots. For them, balance is all handled in the lower legs, where as a human, our upper body is also involved in that balancing act. And like then this would be able to move a lot more efficiently and more human-like, and instead of having to, you know, be built for the, or adapt to the environment, it's, you know, can function in the environment.
I mean, from what we discussed, this right here, you know, this would be the impending robot doom, because you're not climbing a ladder, you're not escaping, like, anything you can do, this robot can do. This is taking robots to an area that, you know, they couldn't get to before, so if as long as they're working for the good of humankind, we're okay. But as soon as they get pissed off and, you know, have the AI and artificial intelligence and, like, nope, humans are stupid, they're a virus, we're all screwed.
Yeah, I mean, they are designed for public safety, but yeah, these could be the future Terminators here if things go bad.
I'm not saying it's Decepticons, but Decepticons.
I laughed, she laughed, the toaster laughed, I shot the toaster. For anyone who's read that internet meme that I find amusing. Also, well, not really robot-related, but it could be. There's a company building the first 3D-printed car. The LM3D.
So now robots can build themselves.
Yes.
With 3D printers.
And then it can drive it. Drive
after and they you. Can drive a 3D car, the 3D printed car after you.
Yeah, the LM3D is built by a company out in California called Local Motors. And basically, the entire car is made with, you know, any of my friends that are cosplayers who built Stormtrooper armor. It's made of ABS plastic, you know what that is, and a mixture of carbon fiber. The bodies are super strong. I watched Jay Leno has a new show called Jay Leno's Garage, and he actually went out to this company, and they were testing the body, hitting it with like a sledgehammer, and it, like I said, it held up to the abuse. So it's a very sturdy material once in this, you know, mixture they're doing.
Yeah, I'm looking at the image of this thing. Like, I think
it reminds me of the old 60s Doom buggies.
Well, you know what? It reminds me of a freaking convertible Mini Cooper.
Yeah, it definitely
that's
that,
what I see. Like. I think BMW is probably going to shat on as far as the design of this, but
yeah, right now, like I said, the it's about 75% of it is 3D printed with pretty much just the drivetrain, you know, engine, motor, transmission not being printed, but everything else, seats, steering wheel, everything is, you know, just printed up in a giant 3D printer. And eventually, they're saying they want to be at 90% of the car being made by the being 3D printed technology. And these are going to be available to the general public in probably late 2016, early 2017. I don't have any kind of you know, list on price, but it's kind of, and another thing too is they're going for is it sustainability, because these things are kind of, it's, you don't need a giant assembly line like, you know, General Motors, Ford, whatever. They're calling them micro factories, because really it's like I said, the entire car is printed, so there's not like a long assembly line. And with this, it took them about 2 months to make a car from start to finish, or from design to finish. And now that the design part's over, I don't know how long the actual printing and assembling of the car, but not very long. So you wouldn't really need big dealerships full of cars. You could go in like, hey, I want the, you know, this model of the LM3D with this color, this options. Like, all right, come back in a month. We'll have it printed up for you.
Yeah, that'd be crazy. I mean, that's taken, you know, the vehicle customization to a whole new level.
Or hell, you could probably even just go onto their website and design your car online, and then they ship it to you when it's printed. I mean,
through the Caravan service or Carvana or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah. Print, you know, print mine with a ashtray holder and, you know.
Built-in humidor.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, speaking of the future, are you ready for the Attack of the Clones?
Hell no. We're not ready for the Attack of the Robot Overlords yet.
Well, China is working on a novel approach to world hunger. Apparently, there's a shortage of beef in China. They're, like I said, having a hard time coming up with the demand. So scientists, Chinese scientists have are building the world's largest animal cloning facility in the world. They're basically going to be cloning cows, horses, dogs, you know, basically farm animals and whatnot.
This shit's going to turn into a pet cemetery. I see it now. Like, God, freaking robots don't wipe us out. The damn reincarnated animals are going to do it.
Well, you're pretty cool. Anybody who's, you know, ever lost a pet, if you could, you know, call up and order a clone version of your dog.
Yeah, I would encourage
dog.
You to read Stephen King's book, Pet Cemetery.
That was resurrecting an already dead pet. This is more like, what is it, that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, there was a movie about this.
Yeah, where they had the repet program where they cloned your pets.
Like, I see this, and like, I'm almost starting to sympathize with the vegans at this point and say, you know what, we might have reached a new low, potentially. I don't know.
Never.
Never! Maybe we can finally convince the vegans to eat meat, because, like, hey, you know, this was a lab-created animal. This is not a...
No animals died to provide you with this steak.
Yeah, this was like a 3D printed T-bone.
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, it's being built in the Taijin Economic and Technical Development Area and should be in operation by within a year or two. So we'll see how. Mid 2016 is when they're saying when they should start operations. So we'll see how, you know, clone beef tastes. Yeah, as long as they don't, you know, turn them into clone stormtroopers, we're all good.
Yes.
And with that, we'll wrap it up for science here and be right back.
Stay tuned.
Oh, you better watch out. You better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why.
And welcome back. This is the Cigar Nerds Holiday Gift Guide. As we're getting closer to Christmas and you still have time to do a little shopping, we figure we would help you out, because I'm constantly getting emails from my friends that are not smokers going, hey, I've got a friend in my life that is a cigar aficionado. What's some cool gifts to get them? And to help us discuss this, we have a guest in the Nerd Cave for the first time. Welcome, Norm.
Hello. How's it going?
Norm is our bartender / cigar dealer on the weekends at the cigar shop incoming. So stop by, say hi, tell them the Cigar Nerd sent you. They may not kick you out.
We'll consider it.
So, like, the first thing that kind of caught my eye, as I always am hanging out and see people coming into various cigar shops that are not smokers, that are getting a gift for someone who is a cigar lover, and go in there, I want to buy cigars. That's probably going to be the first thing I say, avoid that idea. And because of that is, cigars are different to every individual. My palate is going to be different from somebody else's palate. So if you walk in a shop and you know nothing about cigars, and you don't know what that person smokes, a cigar retailer is not really going to be able to, I mean, they can tell you something that's good, but it may not be something that your loved one is going to like because it may not be different from their palate. So I'd say, so, you know, what do you think about that, Norm?
Well, you're right about that. Working in the cigar, working with cigars, we tend to be able to help figure out what somebody will like once we know a little bit more about them, what their palate is like, what they like to eat, what they like to drink. But if you don't know anything, any of those things about the person you're buying for, then it makes it that much harder. Sometimes it's easier to just go with accessories instead of buying actual cigars.
So that's what we're going to kind of talk about today is your different accessory options for a gift. I would say if you're absolutely set on buying cigars, do your research. You know, if you, you know, find out what that person likes to smoke, that way you can, you know, you get their brand or at least find out what their kind of taste profile is. Do they like mild, medium, full bodied, you know, just some, you know, answers to help, you know, narrow it down.
And sometimes too, you know, just kind of add to that. If you know what the person likes to eat or likes to the types of foods they like to eat, you know, if they're big into eating smoky barbecue foods and stuff, sometimes you can, you know, do a little bit of a pairing that would potentially go along with some of that. But yeah, I mean,
yeah, you just need to know a little bit more information to help, you know, your retailer try to pair a cigar to that person. Like I said, you know, I smoke a lot with Brad here, so I would be having, you know, probably no problems picking out a cigar for him because pretty much we smoke the same thing most of the time. But yeah, for someone that, you know, even if I know they smoke cigars, if I don't know their taste profiles or what they smoke on a daily basis, I'm not going to be able to buy them a cigar that, you know, if it's something I enjoy, it may not be something that they enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, typically we like a, you know, medium to, you know, the fullest body possible. And a lot of folks may not necessarily care for that. And, you know, looking for, you know, more of a milder or, you know, sometimes a flavored cigar or something of that nature, which is something that I know I would not buy for Joe ever.
Well, and what it comes to is if the person is a big time cigar smoker, they like smoking cigars, they are going to smoke whatever you give them.
They may not like
they
it. They'll still smoke
it. They may enjoy it a little bit less than they would something normally smoke, or they'd be exposed to something different. But cigar smokers are going to smoke cigars.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, an accessory is probably an easier purchase. So let's start off talking about lighters. You're going to have a ton of different options and a ton of different price points depending on what you want to buy. Everything from, I mean, a good lighter going to run you average 50, 60, all the way up to the high end stuff, you know, 100 or more.
Yeah. You can get a good lighter with a great warranty if anything ever goes wrong with it for about $50.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the things that, you know, as I progressed into, you know, enjoying cigars and everything, as I found myself buying cheap lighters, you know, for 10, 15 bucks, only to either lose them or to have them, you know, get destroyed somehow. So going out, like you said, and buying a good torch with a, you know, good lifetime warranty or something of that nature, it's a one-time investment. Yeah, even though it's 50 bucks, I haven't lost, I haven't destroyed, or anything of that nature since buying something good.
Yeah, especially, like I said, I've always used a Zycar lighter, and they have lifetime, you know, it costs a little bit, you know, it wasn't a huge price. I think I paid $60, $70 for it. But there's lifetime guarantees. I mean, when it stopped working after 8 years, you know, I sent it in, and they sent me a brand new lighter back. I mean, and that's with all their stuff, their lighters, their cutters, everything. So it's going to be a one-time purchase. And as a smoker, you can never have enough lighters. I mean, I've got two, and I probably could use another one just, especially if they have a man cave or a woman cave, not to discriminate against lady smokers, somewhere where they, like in their house where it's like, you know, a constant place they smoke, a nice desk lighter, like a bigger desk lighter that, you know, it's not something going to be something that you keep in your pocket, but something that you can leave there with your humidor or whatever. And so that's another good gift idea. Cause I have like one I keep with me all the time. I have one I leave at the house. I have like, you know, I need like an extra one for my bag just so I'm never without a lighter.
Yeah, and companies like Zycar that you mentioned, their lifetime warranty is no questions asked. As long as you have the lighter, or the cutters that they sell. As long as you have the item, if it gets damaged. Yeah,
you don't need a receipt, proof of purchase, nothing. As long as you have that lighter with that Zaghar label on it, you send it in, they're going to fix it or replace it.
They will take care of you.
And like I said, you've got not just Zaghar, but Calibri,
The big names, Zaghar, Calibri, ST DuPont, which we're starting to talk about a few hundred dollars for
the high-end range.
Lower-end companies like Vector, who I believe it's Vector, that they also have lifetime warranties on their stuff.
And
Prometheus.
If you're getting a lighter, always recommend butane and not Zippos. But they do make a butane insert to replace the insides of a Zippo if you see a cool Zippo you want to get somebody.
Yeah, or the person that you are buying for has a Zippo lighter. You can buy an insert for it that will turn it into a one or two torch lighter that they can keep the insert that they love.
And talking about the torches, there's different. There's single torches, double torches, quad torches. And the thing with that is the more torches, the better. I would say a two at a minimum, especially if you're a big ring gauge smoker. It's more efficient lighting your cigar with the more torches. You know, if you're smoking something kind of skinny, single torch get the job done, but a double torch is going to guarantee that perfect light a little bit easier, especially with your bigger cigars.
Yep. And there's a trade-off. Obviously, the more torches will go through fuel faster, but it'll get the cigar lit faster, too.
You know, a bottle of butane, you know, good butane for your lighter. But yeah, that's a good stocking stuffer to go along with
your gift. And the butane's almost a must. I mean, I can't tell you how many times you've showed up at the house. Oh, crap, my lighter went out. So, you know, I always have butane on deck for my friends as well as myself. So, I mean, it's kind of a gift that keeps on giving.
And to go with your lighter, cigar cutters is also a great gift. And you have several different options. There's the single blade guillotine cutter, which I personally don't like because you've really got to press on it because it's just a single blade and you got to cut through the entire cigar in one smooth it. So it may squish the cigar a little bit if it's not a sharp blade, but like a double blade cutter is probably the one I prefer. The only downside of it is the person is a big ring gauge smoker, like a 60 plus smoker. Sometimes those double blade cutters, unless you're getting one of the super big ones, won't fit. Like I said, I've smoked the ape hanger, and it's like a 64 ring gauge, and it just will not fit in my Zaghar cutter.
Yeah, it'll barely cut the very end of it.
Yeah,
but they have cutters for that too.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you know, speaking of that, I think that segues quite. You know, one of the things I've thought about possibly getting is a decent punch.
Yes. A punch is it's almost like a little sharpened bullet thing that'll just poke a hole in the end of the cigar. And that's what I normally use with those bigger ring gauge cigars. And they're so small. I mean, they make them on keychains. Something that they can, you know, hang on their keys and have it all the time. The other option is a V cutter, which kind of just cuts like a trench out of the end of the cigar, which I've been using those a lot lately because there's a few at the shop and I haven't bought one yet, but I kind of like how it cuts a cigar. But again, with the bigger ring gauge of cigars, sometimes it won't fit in the trench of the V cutter.
Yeah,
I really dig the V cut. I've got a keychain V cutter that I have with me.
I was about to bring that up.
You know, at all times, and I mean it's convenient because it's everywhere my keys are. So you know, the biggest issue I have is if I happen to leave my keys upstairs and I'm smoking downstairs, but then I've got a couple of cutters laying down here, so I've always got backups.
Yep, and cutters, again, range in price. Inexpensive cutters, plastic cutters, cost you $3, $4, $5. When we start getting into the nicer, heavier ones made out of metal with these lifetime warranties we talk about, you're looking at $60, maybe up to $80, $90.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a one of the basic Zaghar cutters. I think I paid $40, $45 for it, but it's lifetime guarantee. Brad's got one of the metal ones. It's, like I said, a little bit more expensive, but like I said, guaranteed.
You know, maybe $50, $55. And, you know, once again, it goes to, you know, it seemed like there as I was first getting into, you know, cigars, I was buying a cutter almost as frequently as I was buying cigars.
Yep.
And, you know, after doing that, 5 or 6 times, I would have already paid for a decent cutter.
Exactly.
So, you know, a lot of times, if you'll just make the initial investment up front, once again, it's something that didn't cost $5, so I'm a bit more cognizant. Plus, it comes with a leather sheath and other things. So, yep.
And what makes it good is we're talking about giving gifts. So the cigar aficionado in your life may not have gotten around to buying themselves a nice cutter. Or they look at the price and they're like, or I'll buy it next time. I'll buy it next time. Well, here's your opportunity. You can buy them something that you know they're going to like. You know that they're going to use over and over again. And we like things that we use all the time. And you want to know that the gift that you gave isn't sitting on a shelf somewhere being ignored.
Exactly.
Or buried in a drawer that never sees the light of day.
Exactly.
You can never have too many cutters.
That too. And cutters even get real fancy with engravings and
I've seen some stones that like actually are made out of bone and other stuff too. That's
with bone and rare woods and the whole nine yards.
The thing I want is the Room 101 cutter, because they have one that actually looks like my tattoo. I'm like, I need a cutter that matches my tattoo. All right, another thing all smokers need, an ashtray. And with that, I mean, you have tons of options. Everything from cheap plastic ones to ceramic in the, you know, the low price range, all the way up to carved crystal. Yeah, like super expensive. And one of the things to consider is, like I said, if it's a person who smokes a lot, a bigger ashtray would probably be better, because if you have one that's like a single cigar ashtray, you smoke one cigar, you don't have to dump it out. Half the time it's like full.
Well, I mean, not only that, but typically I'm not always smoking by myself.
Yes.
So I prefer to have, you know, an ashtray that I can set in a central location that can have three or four cigars resting on it at a time. And
or like Brad with like four ashtrays, so everyone has their own when they come over.
As we're looking at three or four ashtrays in front of us right now.
I mean, but it works. I mean, once again, we're on an 8-foot table, so we're all kind of spread apart. So, you know, it saves people from having to get up and walk and, oh, let me pick up my cigar. So, I mean, it just provides the optimal resting place and everything else for your cigar.
And the other thing, too, is, like I said, if it is someone who has a lot of guests over, you know, something that holds many cigars. Another thing is, I kind of been digging on the, like, stinky cigar ashtrays, which are like a big bowl. I mean, so it will hold a lot of ash. If you're lazy like me and don't like dumping out your ashtray, it will hold a lot of ash before you have to dump it. And they even make some cool, like I said, if they do have a cigar cave, pedestal ashtrays. And most of them you can, you know, put any kind of ashtray you want on it. And they have some cool ones that look like it's a giant cigar with the pedestal on top. But it's kind of a cool, you know, accent piece to a smoking lounge.
Absolutely. So, I mean, a lot of different options, and these are things that you're not going to go wrong with regardless of the, you know, the smoker. I mean, you know, ashtrays universal. Doesn't matter cigars, cigarettes, whatever. I mean, they all get used the same. To your point about the stinky ashtray, if, you know, you're out on a golf course with your golf cart or whatever, you know, cruising around, great to put in cup holders and things of that nature too. So if you want something for the car.
Are you thinking the yep.
That's another thing. They also make
the in-car ashtrays.
Look like a little can, fits right in the cup holder. Yep. If you're one of those, if they're that person that smokes in their car, there are solutions for that too.
Yeah, so if you're out in public, you don't want to, if you don't want to ash in the floor, you can use the little cigar can ashtrays, which are kind of cool. Next up, I would say humidors is another big gift idea. And you have several different options of that as well. The recommendation I always give is whatever size you think you need, get the size bigger. Cause Brad was saying earlier that, like I said, you buy one that's a 25 count cigar, it's only going to hold one box. And
and it depends on the ring gauges of the cigars you're putting in it.
Like, yes. So like I said, if you think you're like, oh, I'm only going to need like a 25 count, go ahead and buy the 50. Cause you'll always end up with more cigars than you think you're gonna need.
When these manufacturers put this humidor holds 20 cigars or 25 cigars, they're rating it for a specific size of cigar.
Yeah.
Usually a little bit small, usually maybe about a 52, 54 ring gauge cigar, which isn't that big in the grand scheme of things nowadays. So if you smoke 60 ring gauges or bigger than that cigars, you're not gonna get 20 cigars in this humidor, which means if you buy a box, which is sometimes 20 to 24 cigars, you've got cigars hanging out that can't fit in your humidor.
Then you have to have an overflow humidor.
Yes, and you know, and that's one of the mistakes that I made when I first got into cigars. I mean, I did what most people do, and I bought the 25 count. I bought, you know, a box of 60 ring gauges and quickly realized that, I don't have enough room. So then I did Joe's recommendation. I bought a 50 count and quickly realized that, holy crap, this isn't enough. I mean, hanging around with cigar smokers and things of that nature, I mean, it's crazy. You know, people walk up to you and, hey, man, have you had an opportunity to try this? They give you a stick or two, or, you know, you start getting in with your friends that are big on cigars. It's not uncommon for people to be like, yo, I got 10 or 12 of these. Here, take them. And, you know, before you know it, you're up to 100 cigars, even though you may have only bought that initial box of 20 or 25. So,
especially you're picking up like samplers or two or three sticks at a time. It you know, if you're not chain smoking them, they add up.
Yeah, they do.
And also a recommendation with the humidors is don't go with cheaper is not better. I mean, you may buy a cheap humidor, but you're only going to get 6-8 months out of that before you're, you know, your seals start going bad versus buying a $100 humidor and it lasting several years.
And I think Norm can probably attest to, you know, this more than anybody. But, you know, my thing when I go to buy a humidor is not only the size, but I'm also looking at the seal. And there's a couple of different ways. I mean, you can take a dollar bill and place it long ways. And if you can't pull that dollar bill out of the humidor lid once it's closed, then you know you got a pretty decent seal.
Yeah, that way works. And another way you can do is when you just drop the lid, you'll feel the air being pushed out of it, and it will cushion because the air is trying to escape slower than the lid is closing. So it'll kind of not close all the way, and it'll get a nice little seal on it.
If it automatically slaps shut.
Yeah, if it slams shut like you're slamming a door or a cabinet, there's air that's seeping out from somewhere, and the seal might not be very good. And I would look into testing a little bit more to make sure before you buy something like that.
And what are your thoughts, you know, once it comes to the construction of a humidor? I mean, there's a lot of really nice-looking humidors, things with glass tops and things of that nature. Me personally, I shy away from anything with a glass top.
My biggest fear with these humidors with the glass tops, and they look pretty, you can see your cigars inside, but that's another point of failure. With the seal, you're worried about the seal on the side, now you're worried about the seal for the glass top, and that can start to deteriorate over time, and then you're going to end up with a humidor that can't maintain its own humidity.
And then there's, speaking of humidity, there's also humidor accessories are also important, because normally a lot of the cigars will come with a humidifier stick and a hydrometer, but it's usually a analog thing it's not the most accurate method. So like usually when you buy a humidor, the first thing you upgrade is buying a better source of humidification and a better hydrometer. Usually an adjustable digital one is what I recommend over the old analog, especially something that's adjustable so you can recalibrated occasionally. Yep. Especially change batteries or whatnot.
Yeah, that end. Some of the nicer humidors also have an inlaid metal underneath the wood in the lid, so it's magnetic. And some of the hydrometers and humidifiers have magnetic backs, so you can just stick it on the top and not have to worry about the double-sided tape or Velcro issues in case you need to move things around to fit your cigar is in the box.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about humidity. Another important thing for me is the temperature of my humidor. So, you know, I personally prefer a digital hygrometer that, you know, not only shows me the humidity level, but also has a temperature readout.
That's also good.
And you can even get wireless ones, so you don't even have to open your humidor to check the humidity.
Exactly, and that's always better.
Be my next investment.
Yeah, because every time you open the lid, you're letting out all the humid air and letting in all, especially in this time of year, the heating system dries out the air. So you've got a dry environment, all the humidity escapes, and now you've got more dry air, and it'll take longer for your humidor to bring the humidity back up every time.
Yeah, and the other thing too is, you know, when folks are buying cigars and stocking their humidor, stocking your humidor with properly humidified cigars will help balance the humidity levels. I know a lot of people have challenges when they buy a larger sized humidor and they only put, let's say, 5 or 6 cigars in there. Oftentimes, you know, there's just not enough cigar humidities from being properly humidified to, you know, maintain the humidity of the humidor. And the other thing is seasoning a humidor.
Yes, and that's also the most important step in your in getting a humidor is seasoning it before you put your cigars in. The Spanish cedar lined on it will take, when it's dried out, will take moisture from anywhere it can find it, including your brand new expensive cigars that you put into it before it was ready. So it will suck the humidity right out of those first, unless you've seasoned it to bring it up to humidity first.
And I think it's pretty much standard that anytime you buy a humidor, it's going to have, you know, specific instructions on how to season it. And it can be as simple as, you know, oftentimes setting a shot glass full of water and keeping it closed for a few days to, you know, some folks taking a, you know, damp rag and wiping the inside of the wood, which, you know, some folks will say, hey, that could potentially warp. So there's upsides, downsides.
I'm one of those folks that would say, don't do that at your own risk. The easiest and simplest way is a shot glass or a very shallow bowl of distilled water inside the humidor and just close the lid and leave it alone for 3 or 4 days. Then check the humidity and see where you're at.
And one final gift idea is cigar apparel. I mean, we like cool shirts. We like, you know, cool smoking jackets, why not? And you can also get cool cigar nerd smoking shirts at realmensmokecigars.com/cigarnerds.html or our Zazzle store, zazzle.com/cigarnerdspodcast.
All right, well, you know, Norm is here. We'll go ahead.
Always marketing.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so, you know, stop by your local shop, speak to your tobacconist. I mean, they can recommend everything from, you know, accessories to apparel to, you know, smokes if you know the flavor profile of the individual.
Yeah, highly recommend seeing your local tobacco shop, whatever it is, because, I mean, you can get this stuff online, but you're not going to get that level of expertise and advice you're going to get going into an actual brick-and-mortar store and talking to, you know, the cigar professionals.
That and your local, you know, patronizing your local tobacconist is how they stay open. So you can have a place to go and enjoy your cigars when if you can't enjoy them inside the house. A lot of people can't smoke or don't smoke in their homes. So especially with the weather getting colder, you want a place to smoke inside.
My basement man cave a lot, but it's starting to get cold down there. So it's a lot more convenient to go to a cigar shop and hang out and smoke my cigars where it's warm. And with that, I think we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News, folks. We've got an extensive lineup. We're going to talk about some new movie trailers, some video game news, you know, the passing of Scott Whelan from Stone Temple Pilots and Velvet Revolver. Carrie Fisher's comments regarding, you know, the whole Slave Leia controversy, as well as, you know, a little interesting dessert treat.
Okay, now we're done. You just told everybody everything.
And that's the end of this segment. Thank you for listening to
quickest segment ever in 30 seconds. That's a wrap. Mic drop. I'm out.
All right, what do we got first?
So up first, we had the Captain America Civil War trailer that just got released. And, you know, here we're getting our first glimpse of Black Panther, Agent 23, Falcon, and, you know, Cap himself.
Yeah, I mean, this, I really dug this trailer. It kind of picks up where the post-credit scenes of Ant-Man started. That's pretty much how the trailer starts. But yeah, Black Panther looks pretty badass. Yes. First time we've seen him. We've not seen... So, you know, Spider-Man has been confirmed for being in this movie, but there was no Spider-Man in the trailer, so we've yet to see that. We see a pretty epic fight with Cap and Iron Man together that was pretty badass.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, visually it looked badass. I saw some of the critics, you know, just bashing some of the stuff, but, I mean, there's going to be lovers and haters, you know, all throughout this.
Haters going to hate?
Yep. So, you know, I thought the trailer looked absolutely awesome. I'm absolutely stoked to see this film. So,
and the thing I really liked about it was the fact that it didn't give away the story. I mean, it shows you a lot of epic stuff, but I still have no idea what's going to go on.
I mean, it's intriguing, and we'll touch base on this because, you know, what Joe is alluding to is the Batman versus Superman.
And that line, too, from the trailer, where it's like, you know, I got to do this, Tony, but, you know, he's my friend. He's like, I was your friend once, too, Cap. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty sweet.
Yes. So with no further ado, Batman versus Superman. I got to say, you know, the trailer itself, from visually speaking, looked pretty cool. You know, I've got some, it was weird seeing a, you know, almost humorous Lex Luthor.
Yeah, then, like nerd Lex Luthor. That's just kind of weird.
Yeah, that was not the Lex Luthor that I remember.
I think this movie's going to end up being an origin story for Lex. Like, you know, so maybe by the end of the movie, we get the more adult, darker Lex Luthor that we all know.
Well, I think, you know, I think DC, my opinion here, is trying to kind of go the Marvel route. You know, DC is always known to kind of be more, a little bit darker, adult-oriented, like, whereas Marvel, there's, you know, some comic relief.
Still looks and, pretty dark.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you even have, you know, freaking Batman of all people, you know, even, you know, making a little pun of, you know, oh, I thought she was with you, you know, type thing. So, you know, even Batman typically is very dry and just to the point.
That thing where he's talking to Clark Kent and he's like, you know, talking shit about Superman. He's like, what? Superman's a hero. He's like, I don't know, maybe it's the Gotham meme, but I have, you know, bad experiences with freaks and clown suits. Or
yeah, I mean, that's not a typical Bruce Wayne, you know, style quote. So
I don't know. Bruce Wayne's always been a little bit lighter, but yeah, that was a pretty. I mean, I got to say, I have not had high hopes for this movie because I hated Man of Steel, but now watching this, Affleck actually looks pretty good as Batman. I will give it that. But the thing I didn't like about the trailer is, I think it gave away too much. I can almost like write what this movie is going to be based on just the information I was given in the trailer. I mean, we see what ultimately is the main bad guy. I think that's something they should have held back on because yeah, it was just, like I said, you pretty much know what the movie is going to be from start to finish just from that, you know, 2-minute trailer.
And, you know, that's been a lot of people's response is, you know, one thing that Marvel's good at is, you know, intriguing folks and, you know, creating a desire to see a film without giving everything away. Whereas, you know, I'm with you on, you know, this trailer. I feel like it just entirely gave too much away. And, you know, there were some stats and, you know, interesting to point out that Captain America trailer views far superiorly beat, you know, the amount of views that Batman vs. Superman trailer received.
But on the upside, we see Wonder Woman for the first time in any of the trailers, and we also got some, you know, a pretty good sequence with Affleck in the bat suit, and like I said, he actually looks pretty badass as Batman.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, the next thing on the list, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some video game news. So, Mortal Kombat X, I've been a big fan. You know, I borrowed one of my friend's PS4s like a year ago just to be able to purchase and play the game. Well, you know, in addition with, you know, the Jason the Predator stuff that came out in the first DLC, well, they are now in the works, the Combat Pack 2, which is going to bring back some of our old favorite characters.
Bo Racho,
the Drunken Fist. You know, we're going to get Cyrax, Sektor, Robot Smoke. And, you know, they're saying his character is going to be more of a fused called Triborg. And then additionally, some people new to the world of Mortal Kombat. Motherfucking Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yes.
Now you can have Jason fighting Leatherface.
Yes, I mean, and I don't know
that's worth the purchase alone.
If that was in the works all along, or if that's, you know, kind of a tribute to the passing of Gunnar Henson. But, you know, either way, I think that's going to be an awesome addition to the franchise, and I can't wait
and
to
also,
see. Yeah, and Xenomorph from Aliens.
Yes, and you know, Predator came out in the earlier expansion,
yes.
So you can actually play Alien versus Predator.
Yes.
I'm buying a PlayStation just for this reason.
So, you know, I'm really curious, you know, to see the fatality lineups and stuff. I mean, this is just going to make the game, you know, that much more dynamic. And this character pack is set to be available sometime in 2016. Also, we got to see a video of the Final Fantasy VII remake. And I got to say, I know you're not a big RPG fan.
Final Fantasy VII is one of the few Final Fantasy games I actually played. I did like that game back in the day.
Yep. But, you know, this not only does the, you know, new Final Fantasy XV engine look absolutely awesome, but, you know, the combat system appears to have changed a little bit from the old, you know, turn-based style. This seems to almost be a bit more of a hack and slash where you'll be able to switch through characters and stuff of that nature. So
that might actually make it a little bit more, because that was one thing, the whole turn-based combat that always kind of turned me off from playing Final Fantasy games. So that may be something that bring the more, like, you know, fighter game, action-oriented game, yes, players like me into the Final Fantasy world.
Yeah, and it was cool, you know. I mean, you definitely see Cloud with the big-ass sword running around, hacking the folks up. But also, Barrett looks like an absolute badass in this trailer. So, you know, I thought it was a cool video. You know, switching gears a little bit, you know, I touched on it previously. Scott Weiland, you know, lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots and Velvet Revolver, passed away. I mean, the guy's battled, you know, drug addiction and stuff like that through his years. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, give a memento because, you know, I remember playing Gran Turismo and, you know, freaking having, you know, the Stone Temple Pilot, you know, songs in the soundtrack of the games and stuff of that nature. So I know that a number of their songs have been featured in the Rock Band series and things. So, you know, Stone Temple Pilots and, you know, even Velvet Revolver. I mean, I've been listening to those bands for years. So, you know, there's going to be songs that, you know, are going to be classics. So, you know, I think everybody hears the song Vaseline when it comes on and they instantly recognize it. So, switching gears, just in some, you know, movie news. There's been a bit of controversy arise over the, you know, whole Slave Leia. Apparently a father was taking his daughter, you know, through the toy center of Walmart or something like that and became offended by the Slave Leia toy and everything. Well, Carrie Fisher came out with a interesting statement that, you know, I thought pretty much summed it up. You know, my thoughts exactly here. But, you know, she's quoted, you know, to the father who flipped out about, you know, the Slave Leia toy, what I'm going to tell my kid about why she's in that outfit. Well, tell them that a giant slug captured me and forced me to wear that stupid outfit. Then I killed him. And because I didn't like the outfit, I took it off backstage. Like, case closed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's ridiculous that they're, like, completely banning that from all, you know. So, I mean, it's one thing, like, all right, cool, maybe there shouldn't be a Slave Leia toy action figure in Walmart, but to remove it from collectibles, apparel, like, everything Star Wars, I mean, that's something that's been around for, since, what, early 80s? I mean, it's iconic, and it's...
And it's a part of the movie.
Yeah.
It is there. You yes. can't, as much as they edit Star Wars, you can't edit that out of the movie.
Yeah, it's just completely ridiculous.
Yeah, so, you know, in other Star Wars news, you know, with the release date of The Force Awakens vastly approaching, an Ample Hills Creamery production has come out with a limited edition Star Wars ice cream. So you have, you know, two variations, the light side and the dark side. And right now, unless you live locally, you can actually order this online, and they will ship the ice cream to you nationwide. Hell so yeah. Everybody can order their ice cream. And
so do
time.
We know what kind of flavors?
Yeah, the light side is a bright marshmallow ice cream with homemade crispy clusters, as well as a smattering of homemade Cocoa Krispies. And then the dark side is a ultra dark chocolate ice cream with an espresso fudge brownie with Cocoa Krispies and a white chocolate pear. And that's to, you know, represent the light still hiding in the dark, waiting to bust through.
I'm way over firmly on the dark side then.
Yes. Yeah, definitely gonna have to try that when it comes out.
Yeah, and the Cocoa Krispies and the light side is basically there to represent the dark side still lurking within the light. So, you know, you...
I just want to know how you ship
ice cream to somebody.
I don't know. I think there's going to be ice packs and things of that nature.
Yeah, because I have some friends who've ordered some like medication that had to be refrigerated, and it came with like, you know, these, you know, ice pack or liquid nitrogen, you know, things in there to keep them cold. And
okay.
And I mean, you know, the four pack of, you know, the ice creams comes in four packs. It's $36. So, you know, I think probably factored in that price is, you know, a packaging to ensure that you give,
you know, in melted ice cream, you can always refreeze it.
Yeah. And, you know, it basically says, you know, there's a shipping pledge here that everyone loves receiving the gift of ice cream at their doorstep, but no one likes receiving melted ice cream. That's why we will happily reship your ice cream or issue a full refund. So,
okay. Yeah. If it's like my like delivery guys, they don't even knock on the door. They're like, they just drop it and leave. So, yeah, you probably have to be, watch your sleeping notification to make sure you check the door.
Absolutely. So, any additional news or anything out there, Norm, Joe?
I think that's about all I got on my notes. So with that, check us out on the ESO network at esopodcast.com. Check us out on our website, cigarnerdpodcast.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at cigarnerdpod. And I always post the cigars we're going to be smoking this week on our Instagram feed and our Facebook page. So if you want to smoke along at home, check those out so you can get the news beforehand. I already plugged our shirts earlier. So with that, we are the Nerds, Cigar Nerds. Peace out! And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We are your hosts, Smoking Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.